WKAR is grateful to its various corporate sponsors for helping us bring you Current State and all of our many other programs. It's surprising sometimes what you learn thanks to them. I just learned a few minutes ago, and maybe you did too, that Art Garfunkel is coming to Jackson next month to perform. And that's because Jackson Community College's Potter Center is one of WKAR's corporate sponsors. So it's good to know that. Art Garfunkel, Saturday, November 19th, 7 p.m. Thank you for the info. Thank you for the support. Potter Center, Jackson Community College. I'm Mark Bayshore. It's Current State here on WKAR. To start our program, in Michigan's 8th Congressional District, Democrats have faced an unusual challenge trying to unseat incumbent Republican Mike Bishop. Melissa Gilbert, the actress now living in Michigan, had entered the race and was raising money for the effort when she decided to drop out, citing a spinal injury that required surgery. That happened late enough that Republicans challenged the effort to remove her name from the ballot and replace her with another Democrat. That effort ultimately failed, and Democrats recruited Susanna Shkreli, an assistant prosecutor in Macomb County, to take Bishop on. Today, Current State's Election 2016 coverage continues with a conversation with Susanna Shkreli. Later this week, we're scheduled to speak with Mike Bishop about his effort to keep the 8th Congressional District in the GOP column. I started by asking Susanna Shkreli why she decided to run for Congress.
Well, you know, I spend my days in the courtroom fighting on behalf of our most vulnerable members of society, victims of physical and sexual abuse. And doing that has given me the experience to take on the tough fight to Congress. I know that there is a lack of, you know, respect these days in politics, and that's part of why I want to go there. I want to make sure that we are, you know, advocating on behalf of great priorities that are going to put Michigan's middle-class families, but also, you know, uniting people. There's too much divisive rhetoric. We've got to make sure that we're, you know, respecting each other and getting things done.
Tell us about your background here. What do you see as your main qualifications for this seat in Congress?
Well, I get more done in the courtroom on it one day than Congress has done all session. I'm in there dealing with some pretty consequential issues, fighting on behalf of victims of physical and sexual abuse. And doing that has given me the experience necessary to go and take that type of fight for Michigan's middle-class families. I'm standing up to anyone and everyone in the courtroom, and I'm ready to stand up to both parties in Congress to make sure that Michigan's middle-class families are being fought for the way they should be.
Why are you running for such a lofty office right out of the gate here? You've never served in an elected position before.
That's true. I'm not somebody who's been a career politician. I never dreamt of being a congresswoman. I was recruited to run for this seat, and, you know, I knew it wasn't going to be easy, and I knew it was a unique situation, but I knew that Michigan's 8th district needed somebody that was going to fight for them, not the special interests, not the big corporations. So that's what I'm prepared to do. I take on challenges as a prosecutor every single day in the courtroom, and I'm going to be doing that in Congress.
What are the issues you're most interested in working on if you're the winner on November 8th?
You know, on the campaign trail, I'm hearing from everywhere that voters are tired of a lack of access to good-paying jobs, that we are shipping too many jobs overseas, and that we need to create jobs right here in Michigan and keep the ones that we have. And we do that by voting no against unfair trade deals. I keep hearing as well that we're risking our Social Security on the stock market instead of protecting them. We are voting to make Medicare a voucher system instead of protecting them. These are things that our senior citizens have paid their whole working lives into, and we shouldn't be risking that now. It's not fair. And as somebody who is saddled with student loan debt, I understand that the rising cost of tuition is a problem, that we need to make college more affordable, and that we have to fix our broken education system to make it work not only for our students but our teachers as well. And that's just some of the priorities that I want to fight for once I'm elected.
You have unpaid college loan debt?
I do have student loan debt.
It's appearing unlikely that you would have to deal with the Trans-Pacific Partnership if you're elected, because it may well just fail. But why do you oppose TPP?
Well, because of that, just like that, I would repeat the same mistakes that NAFTA did. NAFTA had a tremendous job loss in Michigan. We have to avoid unfair trade deals. And if Congress is going to be passing legislation, we need to make sure that certain things are safeguarded, our workers, their wages, their environment, their health, human rights protections. These are things that American labor has fought generations to have. These are things that make the American manufacturing industry the best in the world. It is built of the American middle class. We need to make sure that we are investing in our workers right here in Michigan to rebuild it in the 21st.
But TPP is a unique proposal. I mean, your opposition puts you in disagreement with President Obama, who says that Asian trade is the future, and it also puts you in the same camp as Donald Trump, who calls it terrible. Did you have to consider this issue more carefully than the others?
Well, I have to say, Michigan can't always be on the losing side of these unfair trade deals. And I'm willing to stand up to both parties to make sure that we're protecting the jobs that we have here in Michigan and that they're not being shipped overseas.
We're talking with Susanna Shkreli, the Democrat taking on incumbent Republican Mike Bishop here in the 8th Congressional District. Congressman Bishop is scheduled to appear here on Current State later this week. You talk about ending corporate control of Congress. How do you do that?
It's very simple. That you are fighting for your constituents. That you're not fighting for big corporations. You're not fighting for lobbyist interests. And that is why I'm running. Because I'm going to put Michigan's middle-class families first. That's what this district deserves. That's what this whole entire state deserves. That's what the whole entire country deserves. And it's a shame that that hasn't been the priority of my opponent.
Now, I take it you would support Obamacare. Mike Bishop wants to repeal it. Would you concede that Obamacare might be in need of some tweaks, or would you just leave it alone?
You know, I have to say I'm thrilled at the strides that President Obama has made when having the ACA when it passed. And, you know, 16 million people that didn't have health care finally had it. I mean, I remember growing up without health care. It's not a way we should be living. However, I also see from a small business perspective, I grew up working in the restaurant business with my family, I see how high the premiums are. You know, it's something that we have to take a look at. It's something that we have to fix, but we don't just scrap it. That's counterproductive. We need to be able to reach across the aisle, get things done for Michigan's middle-class families here in Michigan.
Talk to us a little bit more about your background here. I know you're the daughter of Albanian immigrants. How has that impacted your work? How has that impacted your position on issues?
You know, I grew up working alongside my parents in the family restaurant and worked long, long hours. And I've always been so appreciative of how hard they worked for us. And it has instilled in me the work ethic to make sure that I was able to put myself through school. Always feeling grateful about how hard they've worked, you know, and always feeling grateful for all the blessings that I've had. That's why I chose to be a prosecutor in the Child Protection Unit instead of taking that job at that big firm. It has instilled in me a gratefulness for all that has been given. And it has made me someone who is a fighter, someone who wants to always fight for people who are not being fought for. And that's why I'm running for this seat.
Well, also, as the daughter of Albanian immigrants here, I have to ask you about the immigration debate, which gets really intense here in this country. What's the way forward as far as immigration policy in this country goes?
Well, as a daughter of immigrants, I know firsthand, you know, how thankful I am that America has always been a welcoming country and that we should always pride ourselves in being that way. But as a prosecutor as well, I understand the rule of law. And I understand that our current immigration system is broken. We need to make sure that, you know, when I'm elected, I'm going to fight for bipartisan, comprehensive immigration reform that focuses on securing our borders, that also focuses on making sure we have a clear but fair path to citizenship that is going to allow the 11 million people who are hiding in the shadows come out, join American society, and immigration reform that looks at not tearing our families apart, but keeping them together. So that is going to fix our broken immigration system, but it's also going to boost our economy.
Some number of our listeners hear the phrase secure our borders, and they flash on Donald Trump's call for a wall. How do you secure our borders short of a wall?
You know, that is not a reasonable suggestion. It's not something that's even plausible. We need to make sure that we're advocating on bipartisan, comprehensive immigration reform that addresses all of our issues. And that's what I'm willing to do once I'm elected.
You think the parties can come together on immigration reform then?
The parties should be able to come together on everything. That's what they're paid to do. And that's why I'm ready to go to Congress and do that.
Much has been made of the fact that the next president will likely pick important nominees or select Supreme Court judges in the future. What kinds of Supreme Court judges do you think the president should appoint?
You know, we have to make sure that Congress is doing its job, and it's a shame that it hasn't been the suggestion hasn't been passed already. We just need to make sure that we are getting things done.
You would vote to reauthorize the Violence Against Women Act. Can you tell us why?
We need to make sure that we're protecting our most vulnerable members of society, children, women, the elderly at the prosecutor's office. There were special units in our office that delineated that certain people are more vulnerable than the next. And it's important to make sure that we're doing our best to protect those vulnerable members of our society.
Talk to us about fundraising in this campaign, since you got kind of a late start. You almost certainly will be outspent in a district that is considered to be, Republican-leaning.
Well, yes, we got a late start, but we're raising resources. The voters are energized, they're excited. We know we are very confident once they hear my message and my track of fighting for middle-class families versus Mike Bishop's track of fighting for special interests, that we have what it takes. We are going to have the votes, and we're going to have the resources to win in November.
How big an issue is Congressman Bishop's performance in office for you?
Well, I keep hearing out on the campaign trail that people are tired. They're tired of special interests being placed before them. It's a consistent tone, and it needs to stop. And that's why I stepped up to run, because Michigan's 8th district deserves better.
For a long time, Democrats here in the 8th thought they had their candidate in Melissa Gilbert. Late in the process, though, she withdrew from the race for medical reasons. When did you first consider running for Congress?
Well, it was a unique situation, and it's something that I've never, grown up saying I want to be a congresswoman. It was when she dropped out, and we wish her well, that I was approached to run. And I had to consider it very carefully, and I knew that Michigan's 8th district deserved better. I knew that I was the woman to do the job. So I decided to say, yes, let's do this and let's win the seat.
Is Melissa Gilbert supporting you?
Melissa Gilbert has supported our campaign. She has been, passing the baton, I guess you could say, and making sure that, the voters, the interests that were expressed to her when she was running is being expressed to me as well.
Considering the health issues that forced her to leave the campaign, is she able to campaign for you?
We're so focused on our campaign right now that that we're getting out there talking to voters, knocking on doors, raising resources. That's what we're focused on right now, and we're very happy to be getting out to people across this district and hearing the same message that they're tired of pay for play, they're tired of special interests being put before them, and that's why they're excited about Susanna Shkreli.
What did you make of the of Bernie Sanders' run in the primary, and did you support him? Did you support Hillary, and who and why?
I support Hillary Clinton, and I'm going to vote for her come November 8th. But I think it's important to understand that Bernie did energize the youth especially, and it started a much-needed conversation that I think will continue after this election is over.
We want to thank our guest. Susanna Shkreli is a prosecutor in Macomb County, and she is the Democratic candidate for the 8th Congressional District, running against incumbent Republican Mike Bishop. Good luck to you, Susanna Shkreli. We'll talk again, I hope.
Mark, thank you so much.
And coming up on Current State, an invasive snail, the New Zealand mud snail, appears to be spreading in Michigan's Ausable River. An organization representing Michigan anglers is unhappy with the state's response to the snail. We'll talk with one of those fishermen in Current State's weekly environmental segment. That's later this hour on WKAR's Current State. Mention the name George Armstrong Custer, and most people immediately conjure up images of doom. In June 1876, the former Union Army general and Michigan native was killed along with his entire command, by Native tribes at the Battle of the Little Bighorn in Montana. The tale of Custer's last stand is so symbolic as a metaphor for defeat that it was even parodied in this 1960 song by Larry Verne.
Please, Mr. Custer, I don't want to go. Listen, Mr.
But of course, his demise is not the entire story. George Armstrong Custer was a living legend who captured the public imagination even before his death. Current State's Kevin Lavery joins me with more. Kevin, what's your interest in General Custer?
Well, Mark, of course, it's Custer Week down in Monroe.
Well,
near
of course.
Yes. What else would it be? Down in Monroe, near the Ohio state line, George Armstrong Custer is remembered as a local boy who rose to fame. The town celebrates his life this time of year, and this time they're welcoming an award-winning historian to talk about their favorite son. T.J. Stiles won a Pulitzer Prize for his biography, Custer's Trials, A Life on the Frontier of a New America. And I had the pleasure of speaking with Mr. Stiles before he arrives in Monroe for a presentation this Thursday. And we started off where every Custer narrative begins, at the end.
Of course, he's most famous for his death at the Little Bighorn, which was an astonishing disaster for the Frontier Army. It was all the more remarkable, though, because Custer was renowned as a very capable cavalry commander. Custer himself was a polarizing figure. And so, yes, you know, that remarkable disaster has made him synonymous with doom. And yet, both his capabilities and his flaws, the way people loved him and the way they hated him, made him famous going into the battle. So my attempt to understand him was a way of, was to understand what he meant to Americans, how he became controversial, how it was that he helped to transform his own death into something much bigger than the same disaster might have been if, you know, resulted from someone else's leadership.
Custer was not from Michigan originally. He was born in Ohio, but he lived in Monroe between Detroit and Toledo. Did he happen to come from a military family? What is it that motivated him to join the Army?
Well, his origins are very interesting because he adopted Monroe as his hometown. It was very much a conscious choice on his part. His half-sister had moved there. He had other family in Monroe. But he was born in, you know, the more southern part of Ohio. And so he was really a product of border state culture. The part of Ohio where he was from was populated to a large extent by people who'd crossed the Ohio River from Kentucky and Virginia and slave-owning parts of the South. His father was from Maryland. And so he really loved Michigan. He identified consciously with the state, and yet he also had these aspects of his origins that carried over into his personality and the way he was seen by the world. So he went to West Point, I think, to escape those early obscure origins of his. As he once said to his wife, Libby Bacon Custer, he said, you know, all my life I've wanted more than anything else to be great. And I think he wanted to be seen as great. And so I think that was one of the reasons why he went to West Point.
So you mentioned the border state culture that he came from. Is this a man who could have ended up fighting for the Confederacy?
Actually, no. And that's something that's interesting, too, is that when he became a general at the age of 23, a general of U.S. volunteers, the temporary regiments and organizations that fought the Civil War for the Union, he affected this very flamboyant style, a style that we see in the Civil War most commonly among Southern generals. It was very much a sort of chivalric, Southern-looking charisma that he was trying to evoke and that he authentically had. And yet, you know, when we think about his actual loyalties, it was never in doubt that he was loyal to the Union.
We're talking with T.J. Stiles. He is the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning biography, Custer's Trials, A Life on the Frontier of a New America. He is speaking in Monroe, Michigan, this coming Thursday evening as part of the town's Custer Week events. When we talk about George Armstrong Custer's early days, the chivalrous persona that he adopted, this is a guy who graduated last in his class at West Point, so I'm wondering if maybe that bold style and that bold look was overcompensation for a not-so-stellar career at the academy.
Well, I don't think he was trying to compensate for his academy standing later, but rather his performance at West Point tells us something about his personality and how he wanted to present himself to the world. at West Point, he was trying to win admiration, but the admiration of his fellow cadets. He was, in fact, a highly intelligent man who actually had a love of learning. It's sort of surprising as you follow his life to see how he was excited and interested in science, and he read quite widely, and he wrote also in later life. He was a popular writer and almost a kind of public intellectual, at least he wanted to be. But at West Point, he realized that the gratification he got from being at West Point was to be the sort of daring, devil-may-care, rule-flouting fellow who won the admiration of his fellow cadets for taking risks and not paying so much attention to his academic career. But during the Civil War, he actually showed that he had learned a lot at West Point. And rather than simply blindly leading charges, he actually had a great tactical sense, which made him consistently successful.
So after his career in the Civil War, he was dispatched to the West. Was that considered important or prestigious duty back then? Was that a bad assignment? How did he feel about going out to the hinterlands?
Well, you know, there were two stages to his deployment. First, he was deployed to Texas for several months, and he helped to occupy Texas, which had not been conquered by Union troops during the Civil War. And in that case, he was commanding volunteers who'd signed up to fight the Civil War and wanted to go home. And he didn't know how to manage men. This was not the Michigan Brigade. This was not the 3rd Cavalry Division, which he led later in the Civil War. These were other troops who did not have that bond with him that he'd formed during the Civil War. And he lashed out at their complaints with outrageous discipline. He became brittle. He was unsure of himself, and he overcompensated. So we really see Custer, in his first deployment in the West, becomes very brittle. Later in 1866, he's deployed to kind of the classic Custer career as we know it on the Great Plains, where he fought the High Plains peoples, the Cheyennes, and later the Lakotas. And there we see him, again, dealing with the fact that he's not in combat very often, that he is now a cog, a sort of middle manager in a large organization, which is trying to simply keep the peace for the most part, during most of their time in the West. And it really wears on him. And he begins to have problems with his men. He begins to create problems with the chain of command. And it begins a pattern in which Custer began to create crises, self-created crises, which he only got out of by being able to fight and win a battle. So he was actually court-martialed and convicted in 1867, and I think quite justly so. He returned to duty a year later and fought the Battle of the Washita and did everything his commanders wanted in that campaign, and that rescued him from the mess he'd created. And this happened again later in 1873 when he went to the Northern Plains, got into a crisis through his problems he created for himself in the Army, but then he fought two battles against the Lakotas and did quite well, and again rescued himself from the messes he had made.
Sort of a professional midlife crisis, it sounds like. So let's get to Montana now. What is leading up to June 25th, 1876, the Battle of Little Bighorn?
You know, my book is not focused on the Little Bighorn, but I think it sheds light on the great crisis in Custer's life, in the sense that he was going into this battle hoping not to achieve great things in terms of new fame and new heights in his career, but rather to rescue himself from another disaster he'd created by his intervention in the main currents in American history and politics at the time.
This sounds like a Greek tragedy.
Yeah, it is. It's very much, you know, a case of someone's failings being the underside of their strengths. He was a charismatic figure. He had this desire to be great, and also combined with professional training that allowed him to do very well in battle. But those battles were so far and few between. And his desire to be great did not serve him so well off the battlefield. You know, I thought I would have to try to explain in my book, when I was writing it, I thought I needed to explain the dramatic portrayal that Custer made of himself, the way he made this big flamboyant show, because modern culture tends to kind of look down on that flamboyance. And yet now we have a presidential campaign in which one of the candidates is a highly performative, flamboyant character. And all of a sudden I find people asking me to compare Custer to Donald Trump. Well, it's not a comparison I really want to make because it's, you know, they're very different times. And yet we can see, you know, that there are people in many points in history who win attention and even admiration by, you know, really striving to show themselves as being larger than life, that they want to be larger than life. They're aspiring to show themselves as a dramatic character. And, you know, it spoke to Americans then as it speaks to some Americans now. Others, quite the opposite, both then and now. And it's a really fascinating study, not just in history, but in human nature.
We've been talking with T.J. Stiles. He is the author of Custer's Trials, A Life on the Frontier of a New America, a Pulitzer Prize-winning biography of General George Armstrong Custer, who lived much of his life in Monroe, Michigan. And Mr. Stiles will be in Monroe Thursday evening as part of that city's annual Custer Week celebration. Thank you so much for shedding light on George Armstrong Custer, a man who was misunderstood by many people, but a fascinating life nonetheless. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
And coming up on Current State, we'll speak with a harpist with synesthesia, which means that when Dr. Rachel Brandwine hears music, she sees colors as well. We'll talk with her about synesthesia as well as about her concert in Ann Arbor this week. That's coming up later this hour on Current State. Point out there are two more public meetings involving CATA's bus rapid transit plan scheduled for this week. The first was actually last night. There are now, if memory serves, five alternative plans for the BRT layout, where it runs, how long it is, etc., etc. You can learn more about these options again this evening, 6:30 at the Allen Neighborhood Center in Lansing. That runs an hour, 6:30 to 7:30. Then tomorrow evening, Wednesday evening from 6 till 7 at the Okemos Masonic Center. Current State will update the BRT discussion this week as well. Judge Bill Collette, who's become an outspoken critic of the plan, joins us Thursday morning, and we hope to follow up with the BRT supporter on Friday morning. These alternatives, maybe you read about this in Sunday's Lansing State Journal, they did an extended piece on this that is worth a read. The CAT has put together these various options in response to the criticism and the input that it's received from the public over this. So CATA intends to present the pros and cons and impacts of each option. It'll discuss any further analyses that may be required, and it will conduct a brief question and answer session. Each session is only an hour long, so there you go, your option to learn more about the BRT and where it stands right now. Every Tuesday, Current State takes time to focus on environmental news and issues. There's been a growing concern recently about an invasive species of snail that's turned up in Michigan's Ausable River near Grayling. The U.S. Fisheries and Wildlife Service describes the New Zealand mud snail as a horrible hitchhiker. The agency says the tiny snail can consume up to half of the available food in a stream and may outcompete or displace aquatic life, which native fish species depend on for food. It says the disruption might result in reduced growth rates and lower populations of economically important fish species. Our next guest says too little is being done about recent discoveries of the New Zealand mud snail. Here in Michigan, Tom Baird is president of the 600-member nonprofit Anglers of the Ausable. He joins us by phone from between nowhere and nowhere, actually near the community of Emigrant, Montana. Mr. Baird, welcome.
Hi, Mark. Thank you for having me on.
DNR says the New Zealand mud snail was first collected in Michigan 4 years ago in the Boardman River, but more recently, a lot more has happened. Could you bring our listeners up to speed, please?
Right, Mark. Well, the mud snail was originally discovered in Idaho and Montana, and more recently in Michigan in the Boardman and the Pure Marquette and the Ausable River. In the Ausable, we were doing some sampling in some connection with pollution permit in the fish farm up in Grayling, and one of our scientists discovered the mud snails directly downstream from the fish farm. We reported that to the DNR, and you know the rest of the story.
Well, our listeners may not, though. I mean, the DNR acknowledges the presence of these snails in the Ausable, but you still generally are frustrated by the state government's response to this. Explain why.
Right. Well, for starters, you need to know that this mud snail is very dangerous. It reproduces asexually, which means that it only takes one to infest a body of water. They increase rapidly, and they displace native aquatic insects. So when one of our scientists discovered these mud snails, we asked him where they were, and he said they were directly below the new fish farm at the old Grayling Fish Hatchery, and he couldn't find them anywhere else. So we asked the DNR and the DEQ to immediately inspect the fish hatchery to see whether it was the source of the mud snails, and also to determine whether while the infestation was localized, whether there could be some fix or cure to the problem. The DNR and the DEQ just refused to go into the hatchery. They said the owner wouldn't allow them in, and they declined to get a warrant to go in and take a look. Since then, the mud snail has spread both upstream and downstream and into the mainstream of the Ausable. And the danger there is to the aquatic insects that the trout feed on in the Ausable. The trout and trout fishery creates a major economy for the Grayling region, and it's now jeopardized by this infestation. We still don't think enough is being done.
And we'll also point out, isn't it true that the hatchery was recently given permission by the state to expand its operation?
Right. It had been operated by Crawford County as a small tourist attraction with a very small number of fish, and it has been given a pollution discharge permit and an aquaculture permit, which will allow it to expand greatly. I think the proposal of the owner is to expand from under 20,000 pounds of fish per year up to 300,000 pounds of fish per year. That'll release a lot of pollution, a lot of fish feces. That required a pollution discharge permit. That's what went to litigation, actually, and that's why we had scientists on the case when the New Zealand mud snail was discovered.
And that's an expansion of a factor by about 15, if my math is correct here. Let's talk about the action the DNR has taken. Again, they do acknowledge that the snail is present in the Ausable and near the hatchery. It has developed what it says is a stringent set of stocking requirements for the hatchery, and this was done back in August. Was that the right response?
No, it wasn't. It's not stringent, or at least not stringent enough, for a couple of three reasons. First of all, it applies only to stocking of the fish in public waters. For example, taking them out of the fish farm and putting them in a pond somewhere. It doesn't apply to transporting those fish for slaughter for food at all. So there will be no controls on that, and there will only be these minimal controls on stocking transportation. And second, the whole plan assumes that fish won't eat the snails before they're transported. And as I mentioned earlier, these snails reproduce asexually, so it only takes one snail in an entire load of fish or the water they're being transported in to start a population somewhere else and infest another body of water. The DNR, as you will note, says that the possibility of transporting and spreading the snails is very low, but it's not zero, and it should be zero. I mean, we should not be taking a chance of spreading intentionally another invasive species in Michigan. If you think back to the quagga mussels and the zebra mussels and what they've done to the Great Lakes, this stands the chance of doing the same thing to our inland lakes and streams. And all of this is exacerbated by the problem that there isn't any known treatment once an infestation becomes widespread.
Tom Baird is president of the 600-member nonprofit Anglers of the Aussabel. He says too little is being done about recent discoveries of the New Zealand mud snail here in Michigan. The Boardman, the Pier Marquette, and the Aussabel all have, the snail has all been noted in all of those rivers. In a letter you shared with us from a week ago, this is from DNR Director Keith Cray to you, about this situation, Director Cray refers to, quote, the absence of a confirmed positive sighting in rearing units at the hatchery. Can you explain what that means exactly, that no snails have been found in the rearing units? How important is that?
Well, it's not important at all because no one's gone in there to inspect the units. They are what you call raceways. What happens is water from the east branch of the Aussabel is diverted. It goes through raceways in the fish hatchery. That's where the fish are raised. And then the water flows back into the river, which may be the reason mud snails wound up just below the hatchery in the east branch of the Aussabel. But it doesn't mean much to say that no snails have been seen in the rearing pens if no one's gone in to look.
Well, I mean, again, in that letter from a week ago, Director Keith Cray also informed you that the DNR is planning to inspect the grayling. Well, let me back up just a little bit here, though. Where does it come from that no snails have been found in the rearing units? Somebody said that.
Yeah, you're going to have to ask Director Cray about that. I have no idea. We haven't been in to inspect. Our scientists haven't been allowed in to inspect. DEQ and DNR, to our knowledge, have not been in to inspect. So we don't know where that statement came from.
Again, in that letter, Director Cray also informed you that the DNR is planning to inspect the grayling hatchery. Has that taken place? So that has not taken place?
To our knowledge, it has not taken place. Remember, these mud snails were first discovered just below the hatchery in early June of 2016. It's been over, 4 months now, and there's still been no inspection. The problem with that is, upon discovery, you want to get in there right away and take a look and do an inspection for epidemiological purposes to decide whether or not the fish farm was the source of the infestation or not. It may have been, but it's not the only possibility. And that opportunity has pretty much been lost now because of the passage of time and the spread of the snails, which do move by themselves, and they move by being eaten by other fish, birds, etc., as well as people using the river. So the longer the time goes on, the less opportunity you have to pinpoint the source of an infestation.
We have about 30 seconds, Tom Baird. These New Zealand mud snails are quite small, but they're highly adaptable and can take over an area. As a fisherman, have you begun to notice an impact on the Aussabel at this point?
We haven't noticed an ecological impact, but we have noticed, and DEQ and DNR confirm it, that the mud snail is beginning to spread. We don't know yet what the effect will be, but we'll be watching it closely.
Tom Baird is president of the Anglers of the Aussabel, a 600-member nonprofit group. It says too little is being done about recent discoveries of the New Zealand mud snail here in Michigan. Tom Baird, thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
Current State focuses on the environment every Tuesday. Our past segments can be found at WKAR.org, and our efforts are supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. For still more news of the Great Lakes environment, you can check out GreatLakesEcho.org. It's Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Wednesday morning in Ann Arbor, there's a bit of a homecoming concert at the Ann Arbor Society for Musical Arts. They're bringing a University of Michigan alum back to perform on her instrument, the harp. Current State's Jamie Paisley spoke yesterday with the harpist, Dr. Rachel Brandwine, about coming back to Michigan after winning the 2014 Mu Phi Epsilon Concerto Competition.
Wow, that was an experience. The Mu Phi Epsilon International Solo Competition was such a wonderful, wonderful experience. I was teaching at Interlochen Arts Camp, and so I spent that summer in particular preparing, practice performing, polishing the pieces that I competed with. And I entered the competition truly just to share some cool harp music that I adore. It was by Epsilon Fraternity are filled with many, many wonderful people. Our motto is music, friendship, and harmony. And so just to be a part of something so wonderful was really, really a rare opportunity for me. So I'm so appreciative of that.
So you were a member of them as well?
I am a member. I was a member of the collegiate chapter in Ann Arbor, Michigan, when I went to University of Michigan, and now I'm a member of the Minneapolis St. Paul alumni chapter.
So then this concert that's coming up on Wednesday, that's a bit of a homecoming for you?
Oh, it is. I was thinking about this the other day. My performing experience and concertizing experience, being a part of MuFi, has come full circle. The Ann Arbor concert is my last concert, being a concert artist, and I just feel like I'm coming home again. I enjoyed my time being a harp student at University of Michigan so much, and so to come back with wonderful people and to see the new renovations to the school and to even give a masterclass to the harp studio, I just feel so honored to be back there in a city, in a place that I love.
For the concert that's coming up at the Ann Arbor Society for Musical Arts, the program, were there any pieces that are also kind of a homecoming, or is this just a furthering of the harp career for you as you're tackling Britain and that adaptation of Prokofiev?
You know, I program repertoire that really showcases the different colors and timbres of the harp that I truly, truly appreciate. I also program my own compositions. I love sharing my own ideas and my own take on the harp and its capabilities. The Prokofiev is an adaptation of the piano, actually Prokofiev wrote it for piano or harp. It sounds actually quite similar on either instrument that one plays it on. To grab the challenge of this particular piece, it's really easy to turn it into just an etude because that right hand is just so moving so fast and so long. One must be sure to guard the melodic minds and phrases and also to have a sense of direction. I think that's the most important point in making clear the distinction between the A and B sections of that work. And the Briton, he also uses the harp extremely well in the suite that he wrote for Ossian Ellis. He uses the very, very top of the harp and the very bottom register of the harp and blends the textures and the capabilities beautifully with uses of glissando and harmonics and this vigliando and the pre la tabla effect. So he truly, truly brings out just beautiful aspects of this instrument.
Yeah. We're speaking with Dr. Rachel Brandwine, the harpist, who is going to be performing this Wednesday morning, a concert at 10:30 in the morning, part of the Ann Arbor Society of Musical Arts concert series. And it'll be located at the Ann Arbor City Club on Washtenaw Avenue in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And Rachel, I want to talk about something that you brought up a little bit earlier. You talked about color and timbre as parts of the harp that are very interesting, particularly to you. Why is that?
Color and timbre. Those are important words when I play the harp because I have something called synesthesia, which means that in part The word means that I see color and texture when I play music or write music. And so when I play in different registers of the harp, I would say that kind of goes more toward timbre, maybe the texture of what the harp sounds like. And then color, for me, is how the use of harmonies blend and meld and resonate together in harmony. So largely when I write music, it's based off of what I see in my head with what the harp sounds like.
And that, I assume, relates also to the title of the suite for solo harp that you wrote called The Pattern Wheel. Does that also relate to the colors?
It does relate to the colors. Anybody who knows me very well knows that two things that I love to experiment with and I love in my life are color and patterns. I believe that so much of music, if not all of it, is just one big pattern. The Pattern Wheel is based off of colors of the rainbow, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, and indigo. Actually, backward in this work, indigo, blue, green, yellow, orange, red, and it's also based off of numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. And in this case, it's backward, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. So the first movement is called Indigo Intro. First movement is blue, 5. Second movement is green, 4. Yellow, 3. Orange, 2. And the last movement is called Red, 1. Or also, it's spelled Redone. And so the entire work is based off of interval, meter, and key, and a few melodic and rhythmic motives that repeat themselves throughout. And then the last movement, Red, 1, or Redone, is a restatement of, in kind of a mishmash of all of the things that were restated previously.
That sounds exceedingly complex. Probably a lot easier to listen to.
Yes, and actually the interesting thing about this work, I submitted it to a competition, and the time limit was 8 minutes. And so I had this idea for to put this suite together, and the huge compositional challenge for me wasn't actually necessarily the use of intervals and numbers, but it was a time limit for each movement. So that's the time limit. And then anything consecutive that I see with my synesthesia is the colors of a rainbow, like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And so that's why I named the movements as such.
Now, we've talked a bit about the harp, and there's a lot of arpeggiation that comes out in the music, and then a lot of, well, Scottish and Irish reels that are kind of inherent to a lot of what people think of as the harp. But there is an inclusion on Wednesday's program at the Ann Arbor Society for Musical Arts where you're going to do Zortziko, which is a Basque sort of music. Does that sort of, you have to change gears when you have that sort of difference in a stylings?
You know, this is a really, really fun piece to play. This opens my program. It opens with a huge chorus. Zortziko is a Spanish Basque dance in 5/4 meter. And so rhythmically, it's very syncopated, actually. Greedy wrote in all different kinds of genres. He was a very accomplished organist, and he wrote for orchestra and opera and chamber music. And this is one of the most loved pieces for harp that he wrote. So to begin my program with this and really, really capture the audience with the full use of the harp. Again, Greedy uses different registers, and I think that one really has to bring out the syncopations in this work. I listened to piano and violin Zortzikos as help for feeling the real, you know, dance-like in the syncopation quality of this work.
We've been speaking with Dr. Rachel Brandwein, the Minnesota-based harpist who graduated from the University of Michigan and is coming back to Ann Arbor on Wednesday. This Wednesday is part of a concert with the Ann Arbor Society of Musical Arts series, a performance taking place at 10:30 a.m. at the Ann Arbor City Club. More information you can find online about this performance at annarborsma.org. Rachel, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
Very nice. And that's our show for today. Coming up Wednesday on Current State, Art Prize is wrapping up this week in Grand Rapids. We'll talk with two Michigan artists who have an entry in the public vote finals. Gene Falk and Casey Dixon's piece is called Invasive Species. Seems to be a theme today. And for Neighbors in Action tomorrow, we'll find out about the Young Entrepreneurs Academy, a program of the Michigan Chamber of Commerce that teaches students how to start and run their own businesses. That and more Wednesday here on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Wharf. Katie Cook directed the show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Kevin Labrie, Jamie Paisley, Brooke Allen, and to Drew Hill. The Current State podcast, anywhere, anytime, at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Everything we do here ends up there. Check it out. You can also stay connected with Current State on Twitter, at KAR Current State, and on Facebook, at Current State from WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. We hope you can join us tomorrow. It's Current State on WKAR.